questions one should ask the rabbi of the shul. This is only intended to be a discussion of halachic issues. It's not meant to provide final decision making. That belongs with the rabbi of the shul. So the topic for tonight is guidelines for intimate care. That's the title you have on the sheet. Slightly different from the title that was originally listed for the series, because I discovered that that original title could be taken in many different ways, ways I didn't intend to cover this evening. So Guidelines for Intimate Care is the title that we've been using on the emails as they have gone out, and it more accurately reflects what we're going to talk about tonight, which are basically three major issues. Number one, the issue of a man providing care for a woman, or a woman providing medical care for a man in an intimate situation. OBGYN is the most obvious, although not the only case in which that might take place. It's talking about physical contact, it's talking about seeing somebody in a state of undress, and so on. That's our first topic. Our second topic is the topic of medical exams and intimate exams without explicit consent of the patient. Something that I would not have expected to actually take place, but lo and behold, Jeff disabused me of my naivete. It turns out to actually be practice in parts of the civilized world, and we need to discuss that for a bit. And then third, the issue of what I called on your sheets, seclusion with a patient. Those who are familiar with the terminology of Jewish law will recognize the term yichud. The issue of a man and a woman being alone together, which ordinarily can be prohibited by Jewish law, but what happens if that's in a medical setting? So those are our three themes. If you take a look on your sheet, the first source I brought, I didn't even number it because it's at the top of the page, just an introduction, the thought of the Rambam of Maimonides on the issue of relations between men and women and the prohibitions that are involved. He says, "Ein lecha davar b'chol ha'torah kula shiyukasha l'rov ha'am lifrosh elam in ha'arayos v'abios ha'asuros." He says, nothing in the entire Torah is more difficult for most people to avoid than forbidden relations. That's the hardest thing for people to part from. Amru Chachamim, the sages said, "Bishash nitztavu Yisrael al ha'arayos bachu, v'kiblu mitzvah zu b'taromos u'b'chia." The sages said that when Israel was instructed regarding these laws, they cried, they accepted this mitzvah only with complaints and crying. And the Rambam goes on, I didn't have room on the paper for his full discussion of this. But the point is that we're dealing with an area of law which, number one, is considered very serious in the eyes of Jewish law. This potentially leads to capitally punishable actions. Number two, an area in which when people do stumble, it can be incredibly destructive for families, it can be incredibly destructive for communities. The stakes are very high. And number three, something that's very commonplace, because it happens all the time. If you read the reports that come out in the news, I thought about replicating some of the data here on the sheet and then just realized everybody's pretty much familiar with it. But you see reports about about impropriety and things that take place that are not supposed to take place, including in a professional context, people at work and even in medical offices. And you realize that the Chacham and the sages were concerned, and rightly so, I think, about the possibility of impropriety occurring, even in the context of a physician-patient relationship. So the question is, what do you do about it? Because granted the rabbis are concerned about something that the Torah takes seriously, granted the rabbis are concerned about something that has high stakes, granted that the rabbis are concerned about something which is common and which people are vulnerable to, nonetheless, it's very hard to tell me that you couldn't have a male OBGYN. It would be very hard to say a physician cannot treat a patient of the opposite gender in isolation if they're alone together. It's very hard to imagine a halachic world in which a whole host of medical practices that we take as a given would be prohibited. And that's why I find this topic to be particularly compelling, because it gives us insight into the halachic mind, where we try to create practical guidelines in an arena in which we have very serious maybes. What might happen? What if, on all sides? And that brings me to the vignettes, and we'll take a look at the first two first. First vignette, you have them there on your sheets. Charles, a medical student, wishes to become an OBGYN. But he knows that halacha, Jewish law, severely restricts men from seeing female genitalia or touching the female body. May he train as an OBGYN, or need he change medical tracks? What would you think, offhand? Should? Okay. We say yes. Anyone say no?
Depends on the guy.
Depends on the guy, meaning? If it's someone who can handle that, right? There may be a caveat in terms of what he's actually able to deal with. No one here says no. No one here is willing to speak up and say no, at any rate.
Well, that was the most obvious answer.
The most obvious answer would be no. Why?
Because it's not
his ability to do it, he better not do it.
If he's questioning his ability to do it, he shouldn't do it, yes?
There are other options for work.
There are other options for work, and there are other OBGYNs who are out there. Right, it's not just the OBGYN I mentioned in the beginning. OBGYN may be the most obvious case in which it comes up, but it's not the only. Sorry. True. Immorality is one of the big three for which we say Harig Val Yamor, that it's better for a person to be killed rather than to violate. That's true. Yes. Right. And the phenomenon of having female OBGYNs available is a relatively recent one. Yes? His comment was that generally speaking, female doctors are a modern phenomenon. To have women who are trained in medical school, the widespread aspect of it is certainly something new. So that's our first case. And then our second one, which goes along with it. Sally is a physical therapist. And she has learned that halacha prohibits physical contact between women and men who are not their husbands. And this is not, meaning the treatment she's giving, is not a life-saving treatment. May Sally treat male patients? Could a man go to a female physical therapist? Sorry? Sorry?
She can.
She may. She may treat the male patient. What do I do about the prohibitions? She's focused on treating him. So her focus is professional, and therefore that might give me grounds for leniency. Could be. Could be. Yes?
Maybe the prohibition is on the male to go, for him not to go to the female practitioner.
So maybe it's his problem. Well, we could always reverse the question, though. Right? It's a male physical therapist and treating female patients. Right? We can just reverse it. Yes? Okay, Warren.
I would just argue that the thing about not life saving is debatable. Therapy can take them with stroke. If therapy gets better, it's life saving.
Well, I guess it depends on what Warren said is that you have to define life saving better. They may be certain treatments that are included in physical therapy could be considered life saving. I think the case that you just mentioned, the case of a stroke. So you restore the patient to certain activities which may save the patient's life. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay. Could be. Definitely could be argued, but you can always propose a case which is not. You just have to push far enough.
Some are and some aren't.
Right.
I'm saying in her field, some will be considered life. Say you can take it a couple of times.
Right. Some would be, correct.
But they would all need to improve function.
Right.
Right.
Right, they'll improve functionality, but that may not be considered life-saving. Improving functionality means the person can do more things. Quality of life, absolutely. Yes?
When you paint things in extreme, it often becomes interesting to answer or question, like looking at specified female genitalia will be going. But there's a vast difference because physicians, at some point in their training, take an oath. And that oath has to do with the morality. And it has nothing to do with sexual, it has to do with anything. Whether it's financial, whether it's the fact that the person is vulnerable when they come to you at their sick point in their life. And you can take advantage of that, whether it's financial, whether it's interaction, whether it's even striking up a conversation about a business deal. And we know that the morality of a physician is that you cannot enter into any discussion with your patient specifically, generally when they can specific at the time of the interaction, that may compromise the physician-patient relationship. I'm not sure other specialties, as a therapist or something like that, has the same necessary qualification.
Right, no, that's true. He points out that the physician takes an oath, and part of that oath is to not take advantage of the patient in any number of ways. That's certainly true. On the other hand, we're familiar with enough stories of people who took the oath and didn't follow
it.
Great.
That's not an example.
No, what I'm getting at is that it's possible for someone to go into this field intending the best, intending to be pure and clean, and then be tempted into something that he never would have at the outset. Do you put yourself into a position of temptation saying, well, I'm going to take an oath, so I'll be okay? I mean, we do that all the time, right? We regularly commit ourselves to improved behavior before we stumble. It's almost a prerequisite.
And where does it end after someone is gay?
Right. See, I was actually intrigued by that question. I didn't go there with the material for this class, but I think it's a valid point. I think it's definitely a valid point. The question he raised is, what if someone has same-sex attractions? So now, are you going to say all the things that we're applying as far as men and women will apply for men and men? I think the answer is quite possibly. So let's take a look at some of the primary source material on this. Take a look at source number one, in which we see the first of three prohibitions that exist. The sheets are on the table in the back by the hot water. The first source is a Gemara, a passage from the Talmud. Kol ha-mistakel be'ezba ketana shel isha, ki'ilu mistakel b'makom ha-torfa. One who gazes at a woman's small finger is as though he had gazed at the entrance to the womb. And their point is that it's just as prohibited. Just as, I think it's relatively obvious to people, but maybe I shouldn't take it as a given, but just as it is prohibited for a male to look at that part of a woman, at the entrance to the womb, so too he's not allowed to look at her small finger. Now, it's important to note the verb that I used here in the translation. Those who are good with the Hebrew will note it in the Hebrew. The word is mistakel, and the Gemara notes that mistakel is not the same thing as ro'eh. Mistakel suggests to gaze, which is why I use that term in the translation. It isn't simply to look. It's looking with intent, and specifically looking with intent to enjoy, to gain benefit from. That's the key. That's a key element here. So the fact that one sees something doesn't mean he's automatically violated the law here. The point is, he's intending to do so, and he's intending to do so because this is a pleasant experience for him. And the Gemara says that he may not do for any part. It has nothing to do with what part of the body it actually is. Even her finger would be so, and this is codified in the Rambam. What I did here, in order to reduce my temptation to bring too many sources, if you take a look on the second side, you'll see right after source number 9, you'll see a paragraph with a whole list of sources. So the sources that I quote that are not on the sheet are there in that paragraph. And for each section, we'll have a paragraph like that. So that was just because otherwise this sheet would have been overloaded. So the sources that I bring there from the Rambam in Mishneh Torah, as well as in the Shulchan Aruch, in the section called Eben HaEzer, this statement of the Gemara about not looking is codified there by the Rambam, by the Shulchan Aruch, the code of Jewish law, that there are things that a man is not supposed to look at. Parenthetically, this law will also apply with a small degree of variation, but the law will also apply for women looking at men. Not to the same extent, for reasons that we'll get to later, but the same principle will apply. So that's one concern, is the looking concern. Second concern is the concern for physical contact. Take a look at source number 2, and this requires a little bit of explanation just in terms of the origin of the quote. This is from a passage of Midrash. People are often familiar with the term Midrash in the sense of stories, but that's not what the term Midrash means. The term Midrash means, right now? Exegesis, exactly. What does that mean?
Expounding.
Right, expounding. Taking a text, taking specifically a primary Torah text, the sentences that are found in the Tanakh, and and deducing lessons from there using various methods. They're generally called hermeneutical methods, but I don't really know what hermeneutical means. These are methods of exegesis, methods of analysis of a text in order to learn lessons from there. Sometimes those lessons are, in fact, embodied in the form of stories. We generally call that Midrash Agadah, and sometimes it's in the form of halacha, of Jewish law, Midrash Halacha. Either way, Midrash is considered to be authentic Torah, and it is considered to be a primary text from which we can learn law. Yes, it's true that you will find Midrashim that argue with each other, particularly in the area of Midrash Agadah. That's a great topic for another time. But the point here is, the text we are going to see right now does not appear verbatim in the Talmud. The source we have for it instead is a body of Midrash commenting on the book of Vayikra, the book of Leviticus. And this is what it says. Minayim l'chol ha'arayos bal tikrevu u'bal tiglu. How do we know that one may neither touch nor reveal, I added in the words, the skin of, those who are forbidden? In other words, if someone is off limits to me, so as a male, a married woman, or a woman who is related to me in such a way that the relationship between us would be considered incestuous, how do I know that I'm not supposed to touch that person? How do I know that I'm not supposed to uncover the skin of that person? Talmud lomar lo sikrevu legalos, because the Torah says, you shall not draw near to reveal. Drawing near is contact, and revealing is uncovering the skin of such a person. And this is brought in the Rambam, and this is brought as well in the Shulchan Aruch. So it's a second level of concern. In addition to looking, I'm also not supposed to touch. Neither look nor touch. And then we have the third one. The third one is the least known. And that has to do with service, engaging in activities which are normally done by one spouse for another. Okay, intimate activities. So if you take a look at source number 3, you find a passage from the Talmud Yerushalmi. The Talmud Yerushalmi is the partner to the Talmud Babli, the Babylonian Talmud, but it was recorded in Israel slightly earlier than the Talmud Babli, than the Babylonian Talmud. Rav Huna said, even if a woman brings 100 maids into a marriage, a man must have his wife, rather than a maid, perform private matters. There are certain things which he can't ask the maid to do. He can do them for himself. But if he can't do it for himself, he can't ask the maid to do it. What are those activities? Anointing his body, rubbing oil into his skin, bathing his feet, and pouring his cup. Mind you, she might say, I'm not interested in bathing your feet. That's another discussion, also an interesting class. But that's a second one. And pouring his cup. There are sheets on the table. And pouring his cup, pouring a cup of wine for him. Why? Why is it that you don't give this to the maid to do? Either because this is a marital obligation, in which case, in fact, it can't be declined, or because it is not right to have a maid do this. This is intimate behavior. This isn't something that you have an outsider do. And from this we understand, it's brought in the Shulchan Aruch, that that you don't have an outsider do certain things that a spouse would do for the other spouse. These are considered intimate. These can cause improprieties in a relationship. So we have here three different potential prohibitions. One is looking, a second one is touching, and third is intimate service. Okay, having brought all of these potential prohibitions, which you've seen in sources 1, 2, and 3, nonetheless, the Talmud as well as halachic authorities down through the ages have been very comfortable with the idea that medical personnel could treat somebody of the opposite gender without concern. Take a look, for example, at one source number 4, which we're going to come back to a little bit later, but I'm introducing it now. Aba Umna. An Umna is a bloodletter. Bloodletting was a standard medical practice for a very long time. As a matter of fact, I understand that it's come back into vogue. I don't know enough about what it's good for and what it's not good for, so I'm not recommending it. But it was normal. Certainly going back a couple of thousand years, that was a standard medical treatment. I'm not talking about the CRA. I'm talking about something else. So Aba Umna, Aba the bloodletter, was greeted. I can't believe I wrote it in with an A. Was greeted by the divine yeshiva daily. A voice would come out of heaven. A voice would come out of heaven and say, "Greetings, Aba Umna," every single day. Abaye, who is a sage of the times of the Talmud, was upset he didn't merit this. He was only greeted once a week. So he was very upset. He said, why don't I rank? Why does this Abba, the bloodletter, why does he merit this greeting from heaven? But they told him, no word on who they are, but they told him, you cannot match what he does. You can't match what Abba Umna does. What did Abba the bloodletter do? What were his practices? Number one, when he practiced, he placed men and women in separate areas. Realized that when you're letting blood, there is skin that is uncovered. And so he made sure that the men were separate from the women, so that the men wouldn't see the women wouldn't see what was going on with the men. That's number two, number one. Number two, he had a garment with an instrument attached. The instrument is the instrument he would use to actually puncture the skin. And a split the size of a cut in the garment. So that when a woman came to him, he had her wear it, and he did not look at her skin. This is, right, the hospital johnnies, right? They call them johnnies in Canada? No? Gowns, okay. But these are hospital gowns. So that's what this is. This is a gown, and there's a little spot that's open where the where he can operate, so to speak, or not so to speak, where he can operate without actually invading her privacy. And then number three, he had a private place for payment. Those who could gave, and those who lacked were not embarrassed. In other words, when you went to the desk and you were supposed to pay up, evidently they didn't have socialized medicine. So you would actually you were supposed to pay, but he would not have the desk manned by anybody, and you would leave money there if you could give, and if you couldn't, then you went through the space and nobody knew that you had not paid. So these three actions of Abba Umna are brought to explain what was special about this person. Now, what's the common denominator in all three? I'm sorry?
Privacy.
More than that?
Respect,
right? Sensitivity. He's thinking about the feelings of his patients. He doesn't feel like it's appropriate for this woman to be watched by the men when she's being treated, or for the man to be watched by the women when he's being treated. He doesn't feel it's appropriate for them to even feel that he saw something more than they would ordinarily uncover. And he's also sensitive to their feelings in terms of payments, that those who can't pay shouldn't feel like they can't go to the doctor. So he makes sure to protect them. Yes, that's why I bring it here. The Gemara is acknowledging that Abba Umna can go into practice as a bloodletter for female patients. Yes, he has all of these protections in place, and they earn him special credit, but he could treat them. He has no problem treating them. And indeed, that's found all through the Gemara and all through halachic authorities. So, for example, there's a sensitive discussion that goes on regarding the issue of Nida. The laws of Nida revolve around bleeding from the uterus. Well, what happens if a woman is bleeding, but it may not be from the uterus? She may have a wound inside of her, which is bleeding, and it's not uterine blood at all. So the Gemara says, okay, so you go to the doctor and you ask the doctor, is this blood coming from the uterus, or is it coming from a maka, from a wound? Now, we have a lot of discussion in the authorities about which kind of a doctor we can trust. What if it's a doctor who's not Jewish? What if it's a doctor who's Jewish but doesn't take these laws seriously? But no one questions that it can be a male doctor. As you pointed out, it's only recently that you would have had female doctors available to do that kind of an analysis. It was understood that these doctors could be males. Why? We've established that there are prohibitions. We've established that, nonetheless, male doctors for females were an accepted practice. What are the mitigating factors here that allow this to take place? So one mitigating factor is that it's a public place. Now, this is specifically brought regarding the third problem that I mentioned, the problem of service, of engaging in an intimate activity. So, for example, a male nurse is making the rounds in the hospital from room to room, and this certain patient needs a sponge bath, and this certain patient happens to be a woman. Is he able to do this? We're going to come back to the issue of contact, But just the fact that it's an intimate service, this is something that usually one does for oneself or one's spouse does. Is he allowed to do that? Would a woman be allowed to do that for a male patient? So one potential leniency is the issue of public place. Take a look at source number 5. This comes into the story of King David and Abigail. Abigail was a woman who was married to a wealthy man by the name of Nabal. When David HaMelech, King David, was on the run from Shaul HaMelech, from King Saul, his predecessor, he went to Nabal for help, and Nabal was very harsh to him. Nabal was rude to him. There's a whole story. There's almost a war between David's forces and the forces of Nabal. And then the war is averted by Abigail's actions. Nabal actually dies. And then King David, sometime after that, proposes to Abigail. She ends up marrying him. If you're familiar with the bracha, the blessing that's given when someone passes away, Tiyah Nishmaso Tzrua B'Tzrua Chayim, that the soul should be bound up in the bond of life, that actually is from Abigail. She is the one who coined that phrase. She did it for King David when he was alive. It wasn't a blessing for someone who had passed on at that point. But when Abigail gets a message from King David, she says to the servants, it's in source number 5, and Abigail, I suppose if you write it in English, stood and bowed to the ground and said, "Behold, I will be a maid to bathe the feet of the servants of my master." Bathing feet is a form of intimate service. Was she really bathing the feet of the servants? So the truth is that not everybody believes this is literal. Rabbi Levi ben Gershon Ralbag, a classic commentator to the works of the prophets, says that this is not a literal statement at all. She's just showing humility. She's humbled by King David's message. However, this is brought in a work of Jewish law called the Mordechai. It's a commentary to the Talmud, and it's a work of Jewish law. I believe it's from the 14th century. And he says, based on that, we see that intimate service may well be conducted. What's my heter? What's my leniency? Well, it's in a public place. Because it's in a public place, we're not concerned that it's going to lead to impropriety. That's the way that he understood it. And in fact, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, writing in the Code of Jewish Law, brought this as a potential leniency. He says, it could be, if it's in a public place, it would be okay. Yes?
What about Avishaga
Shunamit? Yes, I was wondering, why are we bringing this from Abigail? Avishaga Shunamit is contracted to actually take care of David. We understand that it's physical care in his old age. So I think it's possible that we don't bring that because there is nothing explicit about contact between them. It says that she warms him. What does that mean? So she goes into the bed before he does, and therefore the bed is warm. It's a very hard thing to understand. But it could be because we lack explicit biblical reference to it. It also could be because there we have a second factor figuring in, which is David's infirmity. This is already when he is very old, and we're going to come back to that. So that may be why we don't bring it in.
But it was a private place.
It would seem to be. It would definitely seem to be, and I think it's his bedroom. So yeah. So this is actually brought, this leniency of public place is brought by the Rama, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, in his Ashkenazi part of the Code of Jewish Law. Rabbi Yosef Karo was horrified by the idea. He says, somebody put this into the Mordechai. That can't be. Absolutely not. And Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg quotes the story in which a rabbi in Israel, going back about 70 years, tried to rely on this when he had a congregant who wanted to open a bathhouse with a female masseuse. And the idea was that the males who were using the bathhouse, she could give them a massage while they were there because it's a public place and therefore it's okay. And apparently Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank shut him down. Shut down the bathhouse and shut down the rabbi, saying that you can't actually use this. But that is theoretically one reason for leniency that is brought. A more accepted reason for leniency goes back to what we just said about King David, and that is that the patient is not in a position to act on it due to the patient's own illness. If you take a look at source number 6, this is from Masechet Smachot. I mentioned the Talmud before. The Talmud is the recording of Jewish spoken tradition. And and the main volumes of the Talmud are sort of what we refer to when we talk about the Talmud, but there were also minor tractates that were added on, minor volumes that were added on. One of them is called Smachot. Generally deals with mourning, but it has other issues as well. So here it says, in source number 6, a man may serve a man who has bowel illness, but not a woman. And when he says serve, it means intimate service. So if there's a man who has bowel illness, another man is allowed to serve him, even intimately, but he could not serve a woman. A woman may serve a man or a woman who has bowel illness. The issue here is infirmity of the person, the fact that the person couldn't act on it. But the permission is specifically where the doctor, the person providing the service, whatever it is, doesn't have to be a doctor, where the person providing the service is female and the person receiving the service is male. Why would that be? So there are a few different reasons that are offered. One reason that's offered is simply that, and this is the view of the Shach, Rabbi Shabbos Cohen, writing in the 17th century on the code of Jewish law. He says, my primary concern when we're talking about intimate service is not that the person who's providing the service is necessarily going to be seduced into going further. He says, my primary concern is that the male is going to take advantage. He's concerned for rape. And classically, the sages were concerned for rape regarding a male taking advantage physically of a female. That's the consideration. So if the patient who's infirm is the male, so I'm not worried. He's too busy running to the bathroom. However, if the patient is the female, I am concerned that the male may yet take advantage. That's why they only offer this leniency there. Some suggest, though, that the leniency here is actually, so to speak, less lenient regarding the female patient, because we're dealing with choli me'ayim, as it's called in Hebrew, we're dealing with bowel illness, meaning you're talking about a patient who is frequently going to have to go to the washroom and is going to be covered and then uncovered and covered and then uncovered, as opposed to some other kind of illness. So some suggest that we are stricter here than we would be for other kinds of illness. If you're dealing with a patient who has something else that is debilitating, then you could have a man take care of a woman. It's only because of the intimate nature of this illness that we limit the male taking care of the female. Is that clear? Sort of clear? That's a potential argument here. However, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach emphasized that this requires real weakness. In other words, it doesn't just mean I have a headache. It means that someone really can't act. So our second grounds for leniency is where the patient is really incapacitated and couldn't act on it, preferably where it's the male who is indeed incapacitated, then we would say, okay, treat the patient because nothing is going to happen in this circumstance. Clear? Okay. The third of the four grounds for leniency is one that we mentioned earlier, and that's the issue of professional conduct. The fact that the treatment takes place in a professional context gives me greater grounds for leniency. It's source number 7 is one place this is discussed. It's dealing with animal husbandry, the issue of mating animals. Just as the sages did not want men being involved intimately with women or women being involved intimately with men, they also didn't like the idea of people watching while animals mated. However, if you are raising animals and you want to make sure that you're going to have young, sometimes you actually need to get involved. And so the question is, are you allowed to get involved? And in source number 7, it says, absolutely, Rabbi Yehuda said, when mating two animals of like kind, meaning there's no issue of mixing species, which is a separate prohibition. When you're mating two animals of like kind, one may manage the act itself, and there isn't any concern for lewdness. Why? Because he's busy with his work. He's not thinking sexual thoughts while he's mating the two animals. He's thinking about what he's going to breed from this mating and how much money he's going to make when he sells them in the market. That's his concern is professional. His concern is not personal. and the application of this to medical care, I think, is obvious. If you take a look at source number 8, Rabbi Shabtai HaKohen, who I mentioned earlier, writing in the 17th century on the Code of Jewish Law, says, even Maimonides agrees, Maimonides, who is generally speaking strict on the issue of men and women being involved physically with each other, he says, even Maimonides agrees there is no biblical prohibition unless the context is in the manner of desire and sexual love, which is not the case in medical care. So the practice has spread for Jewish male doctors to give manual gynecological care, even for married women and non-Jewish women, even though non-Jewish physicians are available. They also provide other manual care as medically indicated. It doesn't make a difference what the level of the prohibition is, meaning I'm a man and she is a married woman, I'm a man and she's not Jewish, I'm not supposed to be involved with them intimately. Nonetheless, when it comes to medical care, we're okay because it's medical care. This isn't a date. This is an office appointment. That's the idea. It's very important to note that you have to be honest with yourself about it. In other words, he can say this is professional, but he better know inside that his involvement is professional. A person has to really be honest with himself. And that brings us to the last of the leniencies, and that is saying, you know what, this doesn't affect me. It doesn't really do anything to me. If you take a look at source number 9, classic example from the Gemara in Kesuvos, Rav Acha put the bride on his shoulders at weddings and danced. Now, we just learned you're not supposed to have contact, so what in the world is he doing? The sages inquired, may we do this? So he told them, if she is like a board on your shoulders, then fine. Otherwise, no. Meaning, if you just feel like you're carrying a piece of wood on your shoulders, then yes. Then, you know, it doesn't affect you, gesunde, have fun. Or don't have fun, because it's just a piece of wood on your shoulders. But that's it. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to act on it. So again, a person has to be honest with himself. And let's take this back to our vignettes. The fellow who wants to go into a medical career and says, I would like to become an OBGYN, a Charles in our vignette, has to be honest with himself. He has to know that this isn't going to affect him and he's going to be able to just do this on a professional level. If at some point along the lines he gets the sense that this isn't working for him, he has to walk away. He has to say, I can't do this properly. And that's, you know, not necessarily the easiest thing in the world, but that's the requirement. But if he can do that, then indeed treatment is fine. So Moshe Feinstein discussed this. In Gross Moshe, I gave you the reference there on the sheet. It's in that paragraph. Moshe Feinstein dealt with it, and he takes it as a given that this is permitted. The Nishmas Avraham, Rabbi Dr. Avraham Sofer Avraham, of Shlomo Zalman Orbach, all of them permit it. They do have certain caveats. Number one, with the growth and availability of female physicians, they would prefer that women see women rather than that women see men. That doesn't mean that the man has to get out of the field, because sometimes you're the right physician to take care of a particular patient. Sometimes you're the one who can solve the problem. The man doesn't retire because now there are female OBGYNs available. That said, he says, yeah, if there is a female who can do the job, the authorities, generally speaking, are happier about that. Rav Yitzchak Weiss, the Minchas Yitzchak, suggested that wherever possible, the husband be present to minimize any impropriety. And sometimes that'll work, and sometimes it won't work. Maybe you have another woman present. In the States, I think that it's standard for most intimate examinations to actually have a nurse there in the room. They're doing it for legal reasons. Sorry.
I think it's the same thing here.
You think it's the same thing here? Okay. That will certainly reduce the consideration. There is still a need to maximize privacy. So like Abba Umna with the garment, the same statement is made. So if a man is examining a woman, he doesn't have to uncover everything in order to be able to examine parts, and ditto for a woman examining a man. Not everything needs to be revealed. Rameir Brandsdorfer, writing in Pame Yaakov, recommends against flirtatious behavior, which I think is a no-brainer. And the point is that, yes, we're very willing to accept it, but with care. physician and the patient should keep in mind the standards that we have as a Jewish community in terms of training for this initially. So Rabbi Yeshua Neuwirth and Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach were asked this question, and they both said yes. You could train to go be an OBGYN. The only caveat came from Rav Neuwirth, suggesting that ideally the man should be married first. This way, so to speak, he has an outlet. This isn't just going to be a building frustration for him as he's working with female patients and is single. Okay. Yes. I don't think it changes it. I hadn't thought about it before, but I don't think it changes it. It's true that for him to be with someone who isn't Jewish may be better than if he's going to make a mistake in this. Yeah, it could be that from a pure, strictly legal perspective, the prohibition may be less severe. But I don't see in practice. I don't see in practice that making the recommendation.
Looking the other way, you have the female physiotherapist with the male patient. It's probably for her and for him would be better, like if the male were Jewish.
I think that if the physiotherapist, or to go back to the previous question, the doctor is having a problem, then they should get out of the field. I don't want to say that glibly, but I basically just did. I think that if they think that they're going to make a mistake,
obviously they think they're going to the doctor. I'm just saying people go in assuming everything's going to be okay, and we know that things go wrong because we do it all the time.
Right.
It's how to minimize
if things
that.
Go wrong. It's not better or worse if the person is Jewish or not Jewish. It's still unacceptable.
No, it's definitely unacceptable. I think Helen's question is really just letter of the law, what have you done wrong?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not talking about rape or something. I'm talking more about, you know, people having thoughts and feelings that are not really appropriate.
Yeah, I think I stand by my answer, though. I think I would stand by that. If they're really not confident, I mean, no one should be 100% confident. We're told the pasuk says, "Ashrei adam mefacheh tamid." It's better for a person to always be concerned that they might make a mistake. That's true, but I'm uncomfortable recommending that. I don't think I would. I think there are also a lot of other complications that would raise in the eyes of the law. We can talk about it more after, but I think there are other complications that would raise if someone were to do that. Okay, so the second topic here within the three. The first one was the major one. So anyone who's looking at their watch and realizing we're already 40 minutes in, it's okay. The second and third are much more brief. The second topic is intimate exams without explicit consent. And again, I thank Jeff for sending me a bunch of links on this. If you take a look at source number 10, you see one of the links. Apparently a phenomenon in Australia, a phenomenon in England, of physicians on rounds actually having residents do exams of patients, pelvic exams of patients, and the patient doesn't know. The patient is unconscious. Jeff, if I could prevail upon you, the vignette that I'm using now is your wording, the third vignette. This reflects what was going on in those articles. I want to make sure I don't misunderstand.
Yes.
Okay.
The patient is under anesthesia, awaiting a procedure, and a group of students was brought in to learn how to do an examination, and the patient wasn't advised explicitly beforehand that that was going to be part of being in a teaching hospital.
Right. Thank you. So I'm going to read out from the sheet for anyone who didn't hear. Jason, an intern on an OBGYN rotation, is part of a group brought into the OR, into the operating room, for teaching purposes. There's a female patient under anesthesia whose procedure has not yet begun. The staff physician instructs Jason and the group to perform a pelvic exam so that he can instruct the group on proper technique. Permission has not been explicitly requested from the patient. May Jason conduct the exam. What would you say?
No.
Sorry, I heard a yes. No, right? I thought that was a no-brainer. But apparently, a lot of other people didn't. I don't remember the percentages from the article, but a high percentage of patients said, no way. And yet, this goes on, and this happened, and you know, doctors went along with it. You're shaking your head.
I think it's an outlaw. I think this is old practice.
Yeah.
It's a relatively recent article. I know that in Canada, I've seen letters in the CFA journals and stuff that this is an outlaw in Canada.
I'm glad to hear it.
Not Jewish related, just as
doing
something without consent.
Right.
It would probably be considered battery under the law.
Yeah. I would have expected.
You can't touch someone without specific consent. So to do that under anesthesia would be a complete violation of all the principles
that
we have.
I could make the argument against, but one second.
Not that I can really say, but there is a general consent that a patient signs when having a procedure in the teaching hospital that says part of your care will involve interaction with students.
Right here.
But
what if the exam is necessary? What if this is necessary before the procedure?
It's never necessary.
Never necessary?
If the specific procedure is necessary, then it's fine.
No,
The guy who's coming in for a breast exam, if someone's doing a lower genitalia exam, it's not necessary.
Right, no. But what if you have a situation in which, and I'm not the physician in the room, so I'm asking it innocently. What if you have a situation in which the operation that's going to be done is somehow related to a pelvic exam, which needs to be done prior to it, but she didn't consent to having this done before 30 residents?
That's where the issue of being in a teaching institution does fall.
So if you're in a teaching hospital, it's understood.
To be examined by one student, maybe, probably not by 8 or 9 at the same time.
Right, but it doesn't say exactly the consent that you sign. You want to be examined by one student and not one student.
There's a thing, I suppose. Yeah.
So what I wanted to present.
Ever experiences
absolutely.
Where you've had where a group goes in and the doctor says, check the liver, and everyone checks the liver. And
right. So what I wanted to present on it is just a brief synopsis of some sources on the issue of consent, because I think it's instructive for this. We are taught that we treat patients without their consent, potentially. If you take a look at source number 11, I'm not going to read it out because it's not directly germane, but I brought it here just as an example. A patient says on Yom Kippur, I don't need to eat. The doctor says, yes, you do. The rule is that we feed the patient. Even though the patient is declining treatment, in that case, food, our answer is, nonetheless, we're going to treat you. When we have a patient who refuses treatment but is potentially harmful to others, a case of contagion, once again, we don't listen to the patient. We treat the patient in order to avoid the transmission of disease. There are cases, though, where a patient has the right to decline treatment even if the physician says that it's required. If you take a look at source number 12, the top of the next slide, Rabbi Yaakov Emdin, writing in his commentary from the 18th century to the Shulchan Aruch, to the Code of Jewish Law, he says, the Magen Avram, Rabbi Avram Gambiner, cited Radvaz, Rabbi David Ben Zimra, I believe, saying that if a doctor says a medicine is needed and the patient refuses, we compel him to take it. But it appears to me that this is only where the treatment is certain. We know that this is the right treatment. And the patient is strict only because of Shabbat. The patient says, well, I don't want you to break Shabbos for me. Then we say, sorry, we're breaking Shabbos and you're taking the medicine. If the patient refuses because he doesn't accept the validity of the treatment, then even if it's only on his own opinion, and certainly if a doctor agrees with him, we do not force him. So the patient is entitled to a second opinion. And to say, I'm going on the second opinion, or even potentially without a physician on his side. The patient is able to decline a treatment, and this is all the more certain, and this is the key line, if he is concerned that the recommended treatment could harm him. Harm is a broad word. If the patient declines treatment because he says, I don't like what this is going to do to me, then it's legitimate, and we say, okay, maybe we shouldn't force this patient for this treatment. Now, harm, again, is a broad and poorly defined term, meaning we talk about this in the context of amputation, and we say that a patient is entitled to decline amputation even if that's the only way we know of to save the patient's life. That it's within the patient's right to say, I don't want you to amputate. Well, what if you have a patient who says, and I think most people do say, my dignity is important to me, and I consider this to be grievous harm for you to do a pelvic exam in front of all of these people. it's legitimate for someone to say that the standard human being would not want to undergo this kind of an experience, and therefore, if you're going to do it, you had better ask first. All the more true where the physician has the option of doing the pelvic exam in private. There's nothing compelling him to do it in public except that he'd like to have the opportunity to show technique to the residents. But I think it's very clear that if we give the patient the right to decline life-saving treatment because they're concerned about harm, we also give the patient the right to decline some other treatment because of the harm that they would experience, that they would, something that they would consider harmful. Yes.
I didn't hear you describe anything explicitly that sounded like our concept of informed consent.
Right.
The patient said, "I don't want you to cut off my leg. I don't want to spend the rest of my life without a leg." Does the patient actually know, and is there an obligation in Jewish law for the patient to inform himself and for the physician to inform the patient of what we now term informed consent.
Right. So what you're asking is a great question. In the sister series to this one, up at the Bayit, last year I did a two-part class on that issue of informed consent as well as capacity to consent, which is a whole other issue that has to be addressed. Meaning, sort of where you're leading with this, with the patient's obligation to become informed about it, you know, at what point do I say the patient doesn't have the capacity to make the proper decision? So the answer is, it's very complex, and we can have a class or two on it at some point. That's what I would say for now. Okay, I only bring it because the question is here, and these articles are here, and it's a fascinating thing. I don't really understand why this was permitted. I don't understand why this went on as long as it went on, even if it's prohibited now. Yes.
Informed consent is always informed consent, and you can't say this is hospital, and you can't have a broad release from a patient. They must know exactly what's going on, and they must consent to that procedure.
There's no such thing as signing.
Law. That is the law. It's not a CPSO. It's the law.
Interesting. Okay. Everyone heard it? That the law is, apparently, that that patients have to consent to specific procedures. It's not a broad consent. I understand there was a broad consent when you check into the hospital. That's good to know. Okay. The third of our topics is the issue of yichud, the issue of seclusion. And if you take a look at the vignette, the last of the vignettes, Jonathan, a psychologist, conducts therapy sessions for men and women in the privacy of his office. Halacha prohibits men from being secluded with women who are not their wives. How may he treat female patients? Now, again, thanks to litigation, in medical offices, as a general rule, there will be somebody else present for intimate exams in the U.S. I understand that it may be the case in Canada, too. But in psychiatric counseling, often privacy is needed. There's a need for the patient to feel comfortable speaking when interviewed by a doctor, not just in the psychiatric case, but just but in general in medical cases. So how do I deal with that? Yes.
And if you look at the problems with the college, there's a lot more problems with psychiatrists.
Sorry, there's a lot more. We have the suggestion that there are more problems with this occurring with psychologists than with OBGYNs. I'm not going anywhere near that.
It's really the truth. It's like it's an important point.
Yeah?
Yeah. Because it's a reflection on human nature, you know, that I think that the temptation occurs in that sort of setting when people become intimate in terms of talking, and then it goes too far. And the attraction probably is not there gynecologic exam.
Right. No, that's for sure true. So much of this is a function of relationship building, and relationship building is more likely to take place with someone you see once a week and spill your guts to than to the OBGYN who you see clinically in the office once a year, or you know, even if the patient needs to go in more often, it's not that type of a relationship. So I hear that. I would be interested in study numbers, but I hear the point. So what do we do? Well, the Talmud does define the prohibition against yichud, against men being alone with married women, married women being alone with men other than their husbands, as well as men being alone with single women. The two are somewhat different. The prohibition against a man being alone with a single woman is rabbinic. The prohibition against a man being alone with a married woman is biblical or quasi-biblical. There's some debate on that score. Take a look at source 13, please. Rabbi Moshe Isserles tells us just how far this law goes. It's not just about one man, one woman. He said, some say a woman may be secluded with two kosher men. When we say kosher, we mean men who are not known to engage in lewd behavior. So some say if you have two men who are fine, upstanding citizens, she can be alone with them if her husband is in the city. And the idea of a husband being in the city is that there's also an intimidation factor because he's nearby. We have to talk about what in the city actually means. The men are assumed to be kosher in this. In other words, we don't assume somebody is bad until we've tested him and found him to be acceptable. You could assume someone you don't know is a healthy person. But if they are lewd people, then even being with 10 of them is prohibited. Some permit one man to be secluded with many women if he's not normally involved with women, meaning if he's not somebody who is comfortable enough to make an advance, then we may be all right with him being there. The concern, again, as a general rule, like we said from the Shach before, is that the man is going to take advantage of the situation. That's what we that's what we are concerned about. So the question then is, what do you do when dealing with this? So Rav Moshe Feinstein, dealing with this, explains, again, normal practice is for women to go to the doctor and to even be alone with a doctor in the doctor's office. This is what's done. On what basis do we do this? So number one, the fact that the doctor is busy with his work. And again, when you get away from physical medical practice and get into psychological medical practice, so to speak, the balance of this may change in terms of what's going on, the time factor that's involved, how much is involved that's relationship building versus how much that's involved that's impersonal. But take a look at source number 15, where Moshe Feinstein discusses this. He says, the common lenient practice is based on the fact that the physician, Jewish or not, is busy with his work and distracted from desire. He's busy, he's professional. Even when he finishes his work, he cannot stay with the patient during office hours. People are waiting for him. Even if other patients have not yet arrived, so you say, well, he has time. He is concerned that more might come. If she is the last of the day so that the physician knows no more will come and the aforementioned logic doesn't apply, people still depend on the presence of assistants in the office. The assistants would suspect him of impropriety were he to remain longer than normal in the room. Jewish or not, the doctor will avoid this lest he develop a bad reputation. So he introduces in that last line a second issue. Aside from the issue of the focus on work, you have the issue of reputation. The concern that if he were to do something inappropriate and word were to get out, he could lose his license. And even if he didn't lose his license, people would be leery of going to such a physician in the future. And so we have two grounds for leniency on that basis. The line there about Jewish or not is an interesting one, but I'm not going to have time to do it now. If anyone wants more about that, you can ask me about it after. If you take a look, though, at the last source, at source number 16, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein goes further and discusses the issue of public visibility. The rules against seclusion, against being alone together, apply if people are, in fact, alone together. But what if they're not alone together? I think the camera just went off. It's not the end of the world for me. What if people are alone together in the sense that nobody can see them, but on the other hand, everybody has access to that space? This comes up in observant dating all the time. A young man and a young woman are seeing each other. Do they have to always worry, let's make sure that we are in a space in which people can see us? What if they're in a space where people can't see them, but anybody could walk in at any time? Is that sufficient for them to be able to say that we are okay? So Moshe Feinstein felt that people need to be visible, And not only that, everyone has to be able to see the areas that they can access from where they are. That's where he starts out. He says, if you see the English translation, it's the top of the fourth side. Regarding a window that opens to a public space or a yard where many people are found. So in other words, you're in a room with a window and there are people passing by on the street. If it is above the height at which people outside can see, no one's looking in that window, this is prohibited. Regardless of the possibility of climbing up and entering, yes, it's true, people could jump up and down and see inside, but nobody is. People don't normally enter this way, and there is no concern for it. No one is in this. The two people who are sitting inside the room aren't thinking someone might jump up and look in through the window. If it is lower, where people outside can see, then if they can see the other rooms as well, the people outside will be able to see into all the accessible spaces inside. There is some room to permit. Even if they cannot actually see, but they can sense what is done inside, there is room to permit. However, it is prohibited if there is a room in which people cannot detect activity. So what he says is, you need to be visible from the outside, and all the areas you could access have to be visible to the outside. That's what he is suggesting. However, yes.
Okay, you might answer this question in a second now.
Okay.
Often the person who's going to that doctor is not going to want to be seen.
Right. So Shlomo Zalman Auerbach did deal with this. He's quoted in the Nishmas Avram by Dr. Avram Sofer Avraham. And he said, constant access is a mitigating factor. So in other words, if the nurses make it a practice to go in and out of the room from time to time, hang on, I'm not dealing with your psychologist case yet. I'm not getting there yet. Then that may well count. That may well be acceptable. A closed door in and of itself will not constitute yichud, will not constitute a violation of the law, so long as there's a possibility of people going in and out. Now, you raise the question of what to do then for the psychologist. This is a very difficult case. This is not an easy one to solve, because you're dealing now with a case in which the patient absolutely doesn't want people coming into the room during the session. I do have a friend of mine who has a practice in New York, and he told me that he has a white noise machine, and the white noise machine is outside the office, and that way no one can hear what's being said, and the door is a little bit open, so that his secretary, should she choose, would be able to walk by and see whoever's in the room and whatever is going on, but can't hear what's actually going on inside the room. That may be one way of solving the problem. But there does seem to be a need for some sort of access, some sort of ability for people outside to sense what's going on in the room and to be aware of impropriety. There was a hand over here. Yes? Right. This is true, and inevitably people will find ways to get around everything. Nonetheless, we do the best we can with it. You're right. The point that he made is that you could have a big glass wall, and they could be having the most inappropriate conversation inside, and people are looking in and just see them smiling and talking, and don't have any idea that something wrong is going on inside. This is true. Yes?
The use of a recording device that's known to the patient and to the practitioner, is it acceptable way around that?
Assuming someone was going to listen to it at some point.
The practitioner could say, I made use of these tapes in writing my notes, and you're welcome to a copy of these tapes as well.
Have to.
And then what's happened with it?
Right, but I think to use Zev's term, some kind of an outside auditor.
Available if there's ever a dispute as to what went on there.
Right. I mean, it's funny because you mentioned that much of this, unfortunately, has come into practice not because of concern for law and impropriety, but because of concern for lawsuits. The need for someone afterwards to be able to know exactly what it was that went on in the room. That's unfortunately true, that we've come up with some innovations that may end up addressing this one way or another. There is another leniency.
Sorry. I learned that if there's a fear of losing one's license or reputation,
Yes. The fear of losing one's license is considered to be a, you know, a potential mitigating factor. One other mitigating factor, which I mentioned earlier, is the concern for getting caught by a spouse. The idea that if the spouse is around, then maybe people are, people will be a little bit more careful. There is debate as to whether it applies for a male where the wife is in town. In other words, the doctor is a female, the patient is a male, but the patient says, well, my wife is in town. Is that going to work? The Kesef Mishnah, Rabbi Yosef Karo, in his commentary to the Rambam, says yes. And Rabbi Chiya Michal Epstein, the Aruch HaShulchan, the Rav of Novardok 100 years ago, said yes as well. Others disagree. And the reason for the disagreement is fascinating. I don't know if we have any psychologists here and anyone wants to admit it after the allegation that was made before. But the reason given for the difference by Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach is that men faced with desire tend to give less weight to their fear of getting caught than women in the same situation. In other words, a woman who's in a situation where she is attracted to somebody, but she knows she could get caught, is more likely to make a rational decision than a man in the same situation. I find that to be a very interesting suggestion. It requires some form of research in a safe environment. I don't know how that's done. The issues of being in the same city are being in a different city are interesting ones. Meaning, they talk about the phrase that's used Talmudically is ba'alah ba'ir. If her husband is in the city, then we say that she's concerned about getting caught. What if it's a big city? I mean, here, you know, the husband could be downtown on Bay Street, and she could be up at Steeles, and he's going to get there when? In 2 hours? Realistically, it's possible to be in the same city, and yet be very confident that you're not going to get caught. Or what if the spouse doesn't actually know where she is? Or what if the husband has made clear he's not going there? She has his list of appointments, and she knows full well that he's not showing up. So there's a lot of nuance in this, and we're getting to the end, so I don't want to take too much time with it. I gave you the sources there in that final paragraph on the sheet. The tendency in general is to be lenient, but to watch out for details that could make the situation halachically worse. So, for example, if the man and woman involved are very comfortable with each other, we are less comfortable with them seeing each other in private. If they are in a little traveled area, we're less comfortable with them being together in private. So the guidance that's generally given is, if it's possible, such as in some of the examination cases we mentioned before, you make sure to have another person of that gender present. If that's not possible, then we say, ideally, the door should not be locked and should not be lockable by the people inside the room. And have a nurse who can enter. Whether the nurse chooses to enter or not, you know that it's a possibility. The husband or wife of the person who's in the room should know where they are. And they should avoid the sort of conversation that's going to make them too comfortable with each other. Flirtatious stuff certainly would be out. And that, combined with the potential for penalties, where you could lose a license, is enough for us to say, okay, this is a medical treatment, and we're going to allow it. So again, just to make sure to sum up, and we highlighted the issues of seeing, touching, or serving somebody of the opposite gender in a prohibited way. We pointed out mitigating factors where it's a public place, where the patient is ill and not in a position to act on it, particularly where the patient is a male, where the interaction is professional, and where the person who's doing it knows himself and says, I know that this isn't going to affect me. And that's a decision that people have to make with a real awareness of who they are. And in such a case, we say, yes, treatment is approved, but intimate contact should be minimized. The intimate exams, we said, do require explicit consent, and in terms of being alone together, so that we just summarized before. So I think I'll take that as read. Questions? Anything else? Yes, Jeff.
Psychiatry is a relatively young field, so it wouldn't have been dealt with explicitly in Talmudic times.
is there any suggestion from traditional Hebrew texts, traditional Jewish texts, that there may be something equally inappropriate in a psychiatrist, or for example, being a sex therapist, being a family counselor, talking one-on-one with a client about his or her relations with their spouse or partner and issues surrounding that?
Right. Oh boy, it's a good question. Everyone heard the question? So it's a very good question. We do have rules that define acceptable speech and unacceptable speech. The term classically in Hebrew is nivul peh, for a person not to speak of things that are not polite, if you will. In the context of therapeutic treatment, though, an awful lot may be said that isn't considered then nivul peh, because it's therapeutic. Meaning, just as a patient can go to the doctor, you know, a woman can go to an OBGYN, male or female, you know, a male can go to a urologist, a proctologist, whatever, and describe what's going on in terms of physical parts of the body, so too you could go to this sort of a therapist and have a frank conversation, you know, in the context of being helped. That said, I say this now without having looked it up, which is always a dangerous thing to say on camera. So I'm saying that I haven't looked it up. I would wager that there's serious halachic discomfort with having a male do this for a woman, or vice versa. But I would want to look it up before I said anything more than that. You have a second question, but I'm just going to go around and take other questions first. Deb. Well, actually, that's one of the cases that's cited. I mentioned some before. I didn't mention all of them, to prove that men are allowed to look at women in circumstances which I would have thought would have been prohibited. So that's one of those examples, that a male Kohen looks at marks of tzaraat on the skin to identify it as yes or no. I'm not going to go into the discussion of tzaraat here at the moment, but these are marks on the skin, and they could be in intimate parts of the body, and yes, the male looks at it. So that is another case of this, yes. Yes?
Maybe I missed it, but did we ever get to the physiotherapist?
Yeah.
The heter for that?
Yeah, no, the heter that we gave, the leniency that we gave for the fact that it's professional, didn't hinge on it being life and death.
At some point, it's got to hinge on something, because then we go to massage therapy, then we go to a haircut. I've read that a haircut, you can't get a woman to give you a haircut.
Right, so I'm not dealing with haircuts today. When we do the barber's class, maybe we'll discuss that one. Although doctors used to give haircuts, they were blood letters at that point, though. You're right. The massage therapist one is one that I was wondering about as I prepared this. How far would we go? You could make the case for the massage therapist as somebody who is trying to improve a person's physical health. And therefore would be permitted to do this. I think it's iffy. The reason I think it's iffy goes back to that case with Rabbi Pesach Frank and the one who wanted to have the massage therapist there with all the for the men. The case I mentioned in the beginning. I could see the argument for it, but I'm a little bit uncomfortable with it. I'd probably draw the line somewhere around there. But that's guesswork right now. The physical therapist, on the other hand, is someone who is looking at restoring specific physical function, day-to-day function, you know, occupational therapy, physical therapy. These are well-defined fields of activity, and it's from what I know of it, which isn't enough, we would consider those actions to be on the medical side, on the professional side, and on the side of detachment, where the practitioner is not drawn into other things. They're doing something very specific. As a matter of fact, good enough. Jeff?
Is there any issue, thinking about chiropractic care, naturopathy, these physicians, like as recently as last week by the College of that we're not to recommend any form of therapy unless there's scientific evidence to support it. So the question is, some of my best friends are chiropractors and naturopaths. Can I, as a Jew, go into a field where arguably I will have a therapeutic relationship with a patient, quite apart from the issue of gender, more of an issue of consent. If, in fact, you argue that there is not sufficient scientific evidence behind some other health professions, is that something that you have permission to do according to
the law? Right. So it's a really good question, but it's way beyond the scope for today. I'm going to touch on it a little bit in the class at the Bayit. Next week, the Bayit is having its monthly class. That'll be on Sunday morning. And the topic is actually IV injections on Shabbos. But one of your good friends who's a chiropractor asked me about acupuncture. So I'm going to touch on acupuncture as part of that class. But right now I'm not versed enough to be able to give an intelligent answer. Certainly not in 10 seconds or less. So I'm gonna defer on that one. Our next class for this series is, I think, in late January, and our topic is taking call on Shabbos. So that's certainly a fun one, and come ready with your questions, I guess. Thank you very much.